laws. Laws don't govern. Men do. The same men who governed before are here now in that room. They have his ear. We've got to be clean now.
First, the land must be given back.
And if Mother Hill doesn't do it?
Yes.
Then he's an enemy, too.
You're his emissary, his officer, his friend.
I'm a friend to no one and to nothing except logic.
Resistance calling. White Aryan Resistance calling. This is the White Aryan Resistance Radio Network. Your host for today's show is Tom Metzger, Terrible Tommy. So get a spot of tea. Sit down and relax, because it's time for another show on the White Aryan Resistance Radio Network.
Time. God bless America. Once again, respectfully, I say to myself, what the fuck does that mean? God bless America? Is that a request? Is that a demand? Is that a suggestion? Politicians say it at the end of every speech, as if it were some sort of verbal tic that they can't get rid of. God bless you and God bless America. God bless you and God bless America. I guess they figure if they leave it out, someone's going to think they're bad Americans. Let me tell you a little secret about God, folks. God does not give a flying fuck about America, okay? He doesn't care. He never cared about this country. He never has. He never will. He doesn't care about this country any more than he cares about Mongolia, Transylvania, Pittsburgh, the Suez Canal, or the North Pole. He simply doesn't care, okay? He doesn't care. Listen. Hey, there are 200 countries in the world now. Do these people honestly think that God is sitting around picking out his favorites? Why would he do that? Why would God have a favorite country? And why would it be America out of all the countries? Because we have the most money? Because he likes our national anthem? Maybe it's because he heard we have 18 delicious flavors of classic rice-a-roni. It's delusional thinking. It's delusional thinking. And Americans are not alone with these sort of delusions. Military cemeteries around the world are packed with brainwashed, dead soldiers who were convinced God was on their side. America prays for God to destroy our enemies. Our enemies pray for God to destroy us. Somebody's going to be disappointed. Somebody's wasting their fucking time. Could it be everyone? Now. If people want to say God bless America, that's their business. I don't care. But here's what I don't understand. If they say God bless America, presumably they believe in God. And if they do, they must have heard God loved everyone. That's what he said. He loved everyone and he loved them equally. So why would these people ask God to do something that went against his own teachings? You know what these God bless America people ought to do? They ought to check with that Jesus fellow they're so crazy about. They're always talking about what would Jesus do? What would Jesus do? They don't want to know so they can do it. They just want to know so they can tell other people to do it. Well, I'll tell you what Jesus would have done. I'll tell you what Jesus would have done. He would have got up on the top of the Empire State Building and said, God bless everyone around the world forever and ever till the end of time. That's what Jesus would have done. And that's what these people should do. Or else they should admit that God bless America is really just some sort of an empty slogan with no real meaning except for something vague like, good luck. Good luck, America. You're on your own. Which is a little bit closer to the truth.
I love logic and straight talk, especially on Monday morning. Give it to me right in the puss, man. I want it straight. Don't give me this crap. These politicians going around like he says, God bless America, God bless me. You know, all that stuff. Jeez. Yeah, that's my guy. That's the Pope of the Church of What's Happening Now. Yeah, and it's Monday morning. Yeah, like I said, and it's May the 16th, 2016. How about that? And it's a beautiful day here in Indiana. It's been a little chilly, though. It's been got down to 34 last night or night before. I forget which, but that's pretty cold for May. I don't think they're finding many mushrooms out there. And I don't think a lot of people are planting a lot of their seeds yet either, because I think it's still ground's still too cold, man. I looked out at my bird sanctuary out here this morning, and we had sparrows hugging the robins and woodpeckers hugging the crows, man. They're trying to keep warm. A lot of fun watching these birds and the aggression and how birds play and how they fight and how different breeds fight each other, you know, especially when I got it set up with a flat surface where several birds can get on at one time and watch them. And it's funny. And one of the funny things is sparrows. People laugh about sparrows, but they're pretty cool. They seem to be able to get in there around the big birds and not have too much trouble. And they will get up and sort of fight a little bit. So anyhow, that's very interesting, the aggression. The most surprising aggression comes out of the dove. The dove is always sold as a bird of peace and all that kind of stuff. Yeah, they're pretty peaceful, but boy, when they get their asses up in the air, man, they let them know. They'll chase the blackbirds off. They'll chase all these other, you know, cardinals and blue jays and woodpeckers. The doves just sit there and relax until it's time to pounce. It's good. We're at P.O. Box 401, as usual, right here in the relatively small city, or near the small city of Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. There's quite a bit of money in this town. Got these big medical splint manufacturing companies. They've got three or four of them. And it's where they make all these replacement elbows and hip pieces and all that kind of stuff. Boy, they get a lot of money for that stuff. Senior citizens. They got an airport out here that jets are flying in all the time. Business jets. I'm telling you, man. That's why they're not too happy about Terrible Tommy being around here. I just put up a new sign on the fence. White revolution, the only solution. And all these upper middle class bastards that live in these super big houses out here in the country, they got to go by that sign every morning. And school buses have to go by it too. Yeah, man, that's fun. I like to do that. And once in a while, somebody honks like, hey, that's okay. I like that stuff, man. You must be a white supremacist. Well, you know, I got to thinking about it. They call us white supremacists no matter what we say anyhow. We might as well say, well, I'm not a race mixer. If I got to choose between white supremacy and race mixing, I'll take white supremacy any day of the week, right? I'm just going to quit correcting them when they say that. I'm not going to argue with them. I'm going to say, oh, okay. I'm a racist? Yeah, okay. White supremacist? Well, whatever. Whatever yanks your crank. I just don't want to regret that I didn't say something that I should have said and wanted to say but didn't say it before I cash in my chips, man. I want to say exactly the way I feel every day of the week. And no backing down. No backing down. Well, guess what? Phil Robinson, the guy that, duck calls? The duck man? That whole duck family from down there in the bayou? Well, he's a religious fanatic. Christ insanity, man. He's made a movie. It's being pushed by the right wing, like Breitbart and all these people. And Breitbart took it to the Cannes Film Festival, which is opening up today or tomorrow. And so they're running that damn film, Christ Insanity movie. And they're running this Clinton Cash film, too. I haven't seen that. But that's, of course, Republican ammunition against the Democrats. And that's the way that goes. I just want to know where Breitbart gets its money. They never ask for money. and they're all over the world. They got headquarters all over the world. And they got headquarters right there, like I said, in Manhattan in the big tall building with all the banksters. And most of them came out of the liberal business world, corporate business world. They came out of Harvard and they came out of the big banks there in New York and everything else. Suddenly they're the right-wing spokesman for the country. Yeah. There's a book I want to go through it with you, that I've gone through it once before, quite a ways back, but you might have missed it. It's called The War Myth in the United States History. It's a very important book, one of the most important books in my library. It was put out by anti-war people back in 1927. And there's a hell of a lot of truth and real history to it, and why I tend to be anti-war. And I'm all for personal protection, your town, your house, your family, your local area. But beyond that, I see everything else being fratricide, or killing white people. At least that's the way it's been for a long, long time. Now, we're doing a lot more killing of non-white people now. Like Vietnam, we killed a few million over there. Do you know what that was about? What the hell was Vietnam about? 50,000 Americans died. I imagine at least two-thirds of them were white. What was that all about? Well, this little book sort of gives us an idea, even though it didn't talk, of course, about Vietnam, because the man who wrote it was dead long before Vietnam. The War Myth in United States History. Professor Hamlin's book seems, this is introduction, seems to me not merely interesting, but extremely important. No man who cares for the story of his country can afford to neglect it. I would say even beyond that, his race. The plan of the work is suggested by the title. The time has come to ask soberly regarding every war in which the United States has been engaged from the beginning up until before the World War II, whether it had to be, and if it had to be, why. We want to know frankly in our wars have brought us glory, if our wars have brought us glory. It is already easy to see what the wars of other nations, and especially of those who have fought against us, have entailed upon them: shame, cruel measures, oppression of the poor, suppression of liberties, violation of the law, destruction of wealth, and immeasurable futility. But we were told that our wars had been different. Our wars had been sacred. Our sovereignty could do no wrong. I guess he means American exceptionalism. Had we not solemnly thanked God for his help in winning every one of the wars? Yeah, right. The Great World War has brought mankind. Now, this is the First World War, which, when this book was written, was only over but a few years. Brought us a new surprising conclusion, such as probably never before prevailed at the end of the war, leading people of all nations, in all the nations, are at one in the conclusion that no thoughtful person in this country which entered the war knew of any adequate reason why his government should spend the blood of its people. As Mr. Lloyd George has said of England, no one intended the war, but we all staggered and stumbled into it. It came upon the world like an epidemic of mania. Well, there's some people who wanted it, that's for sure. And that's why I'm trying to point out to you many times that the Jews can be blamed in the First World War. They were very, very, very much involved in the First World War. So if you don't like the Second World War, you shouldn't have let the Jews get away with it in the First World War, and also the predatory capitalists. It is evident also that its coming was directly related to the prevailing fashion of preparedness for war, and to the fear and suspiciousness that everywhere attended its preparedness. Well, preparedness means lots of profit, lots of money made from making arms. They can make the excuse, oh, we just want to defend ourselves. That's why we're building so much arms. That's why we need $1 trillion for war production in this country every year. Suspicious that everywhere attended this preparedness, it had been the barbarous expectation for ages that war must come every once or so often as a plague comes. Was not the world full of barbarous people and therefore barbarous nations? Professor Hamlin boldly carries over all the wars of our United States into the broad generalization, which includes the wars of other nations. They all belong together among the old world evils, like slavery and witchcraft, which it is our business to clear away from the earth. We apologize for them no longer. We propose not to expect them nor prepare at tremendous expense to the suffer and die when they come. We propose rather through simple, humane, and rational measures to provide never to endure them again. Professor Hamlin accordingly takes up in a rapid survey the analysis each one of the seven major wars through which the larger part of our total national expenditures have been devoured. He proceeds like a skillful surgeon, without passion or partisanship, with a trace of sympathy for all the groups and parties, insofar as all were alike victims of misunderstanding, ignorance of the facts, and the hereditary prejudices and delusions. Save for the great common human characteristics, which gleam out among all people, and on all both sides in times of calamity, the patience, the heroism, the self-sacrifice, the exceptional acts of magnanimity, he finds nothing whatever holy in a single one of our national wars, but rather the manifestation of every mean, cruel, and cowardly trait which has ever debased human nature. He can discover in the case of no one of these wars any evidence that the body of the people or the intelligently informed majority in it, or even the government, had taken pains to assure themselves either of the justice or the necessity of going to war, or that their leaders were ever able to assign a just and sufficient reason and purpose compelling them to resort to war. Thus he brings to light what everyone ought by this time to know, that the Revolutionary War, far from being undertaken by the will of the free citizenry, was actually forced upon the American people by a small minority in the teeth of earnest opposition of a highly respectable percentage of thoughtful citizens, while another large part of the colonists was quite indifferent to the issue. Professor Hamlin also makes it clear that in all our wars, exactly as in those we usually reprobate, our people were presently found practicing the same injustices, indignities, lying defamations, detestable acts of revenge, outrages on innocent women and children, upon the fears which we had hastily assumed excuse for ourselves in rushing into war. In all our wars, we have boasted of our American ardor for liberty. Professor Hamlin's book shows how every great war required the most terrible form of slavery, namely conscription or the draft, in which the individual is stripped of the normal use of his conscience and judgment. In order to drive men to submit to this degradation, the government itself, even in the hands of best men, must resort to the employment of unscrupulous lying, reckless propaganda, in the abuse of the enemy and the suppression of the truth, of free speech and open-mindedness, in short, a debauch of the miseducated, and a general corruption of the whole population. Once in war, it will do to let good be known of the enemy. Never. War counts upon the plentiful outpouring of passion and hatred. The church is also pressed in a wartime to undertake the defense of doing evil that good may come, and to strain their arguments over the verge of hypocrisy in making the worse appear better reason. So altogether, hell is let loose, and the church supported. The worst of it is that the lower passions, once let loose, do not willingly return under control, but remain to haunt the earth. Once more, Professor Hamlet shows how in each case after a war, the whole horrible storm flattens out into waste, corruption, and futility. The World War is the most colossal demonstration of this condition. If a people thought that they knew what they were fighting for, they failed to get it. The victor proves often, at last, to be the vanquished. Boy, well, that's happened several times to the United States. It is curious now, in looking back at the Civil War, to note that the reason which chiefly persuaded good and chivalrous souls to engage in it was to put an end to slavery. This, at best, was dealing in the wrong way with that evil. That is, overcoming it with evil. Of course, the evil was bringing them over here, and the rich brought them over here, and then the failure to return them back to Africa. But Mr. Lincoln would not admit that we were at war against slavery. We were at war, as the government held, to put down a secession, whereas we had begun the National Union by a war of secession. Our government would have liked at the time of the War of 1812 to get Canada by secession or capture. We fought with Mexico to secure the results of secession of Texas. We refused in 1898 to accept a peaceful method to separate Cuba from Spain, but insisted upon fighting to the effect separation. And we still keep armed forces in the Philippine Islands against the protest of the inhabitants. Mr. Roosevelt, that's Teddy Roosevelt, was quick to postulate the right of secession in the case of Panama. As to the Great War, our President Wilson proclamation in favor of the natural right of small nations to secede has become one of the slogans of mankind, as has been often remarked, quote, "This is a queer world," unquote. I guess that has double meaning. Professor Hamlet's little book is at least an easy reductio ad absurdum for war. Okay, chapter 1. Patriotism and peace. For the first 135 years of history of this republic, the total expenditure for the federal treasury was approximately $66 million. Of this total expenditure, approximately $56 million was for warfare. Isn't that amazing? From 1775 to 1923, the United States Army was engaged in 110 conflicts comprising about 8,600 battles and a casualty list of approximately 1,280,000 men. Of course, most of these conflicts were minor. This study will include only the six major wars in which we have been participants. The most common fallacy in the study of history is the blind acceptance that which has happened as inevitable in the course of events. This is a form of collective fatalism. In other words, nothing you can do about it. It reduces history to a study of the dead past with no message for today. This view is the very opposite of democracy. Democracy assumes that the group has control over its actions, that they're not the result of blind fatalism. To look upon past events as inevitable makes man the victim of forces over which he can have no control. It makes man a slave. This fatalism is incompatible with democracy. The Democrat must study history not to discover the forces of fate, but to discover more perfect rules of human conduct. Primarily, the study of the past should be to throw light on the present and the future so that we might profit by the wisdom and the mistakes of the past. But to do this, we cannot accept collective fatalism as our attitude towards history. Until the beginning of the 19th century, the study of history was a study of the Greeks and the Romans. It was a study of the ancients only. Early in the 19th century, with the rise of nationalism, especially intensified by the French Revolution, all nations began introducing the study of their national history in their elementary schools. The object of this was to teach patriotism. Examine their meaning of patriotism, and you find it meant the support of the king on the throne. All text and instruction exalted the nation to show the superiorities to others. Patriotism meant national propaganda. With the rise of the democracy, patriotism began to shift to mean the support of the group, pro-group rather than pro-king. This was the cause and the result of the national mindset. Patriotism became the international hatred measured in terms of military service. This attitude towards history caused the teaching and writing of history to be largely national propaganda by interpreting all the wars of a nation as defensive, with the opponents always the offensive nation. Well, you see, that's why we once had a war department in this country. And I think it was around the time of World War II or shortly after it became the Defense Department. So everything we do, no matter what we do, is defensive. And it's easier to sell the taxpayers on trillion-dollar budgets for war material if we say it's for defense, even when we are involved in wars all over the world and occupations. The greatest difference between the present peace movement and the previous ones is now among many of those who study the problem, the offensive-defensive relationship in warfare. It's being not only questioned but rejected. All nations picture their side as defensive. Previous peace movements accept this attitude. Accordingly, when a conflict arose, these opponents of war usually yielded to the pressure because they thought their nation was being attacked by an aggressor. But a careful study of history does not warrant such an idea. The effective element of the present peace movement is based chiefly on the fact that there is no nation of sole guilt in any war once the facts are studied carefully. The following study is an attempt to show that our wars there has not been the sole innocence of the United States, as opposed to the sole guilt of our opponents, that its wars are defensive against an offensive enemy, in the war myth of every country. This national bias makes it easy for the military party to dominate and to participate in war. Yet warfare is not popular if measured in the terms of voluntary support of the citizenship in time of war. It was hard for the colonies to induce as many as 250,000 men to join the revolutionary forces out to control a population of over 3 million. And only a part of the 250,000 were enlisted at any one time. In the Civil War, both sides were forced to use the draft, or the war would have collapsed. No major war of modern times could have been fought without the draft. This would be enough to show that warfare is not popular if judged by actual voluntary support of the on the field of battle. Well, nowadays it's they bribe you to join up. If you're out of a job, well, we'll give you a job, and we'll send you to college after you get back, and all that kind of stuff. So they entice people in. One often hears that warfare is a manifestation of human nature and will be eliminated only through long evolutionary process. But the same thing has been said about slavery, dueling, and witchcraft, and many other evils now eliminated. Warfare is not dependent upon human nature, but upon the human point of view, and this point of view can be altered by education. Education which is honest, which can sift the true from the false, which does not close its eyes to the powerful role played by economic capitalism and other social forces in the wars of the nation. Whether there was another way out in these conflicts, whether the results aimed at were achieved, whether the ruin and the destruction which went hand in hand with these conflicts not ever be balanced by material acquisition, these are questions the reader must decide for himself. This book simply lays the facts before him. And a bottom line is fratricide. Fratricide. The killing of people of your own race. The Revolutionary War is next. And this is why lately I've become to think about the fact that maybe we should have never rebelled against the king. In the long run, I think it would have been better if we'd just maybe stayed with Britain. Not that there wasn't a lot of reasons for giving them hell, but probably not strong enough to go to war, because they would eventually, as the colonies became more powerful, the British government would have had to yield to many of the demands. And so that puts me as a, the conservatives love me. Maybe we shouldn't have had the revolution. Really, you know, by the time they got set up in Washington with the new government, it was almost as despotic and sometimes more than the British. If you'd be honest about it, the Revolutionary War in no sense is an attempt being made here to give a complete history of the causes of the war for the independence of the United States. This simply is a brief analysis of the 10 outstanding causes and the nature of the conflict without defending or opposing either side in the struggle. The common opinion of the United States regarding the American Revolution is that it was a war waged against Britain, in which the American people as a whole rose up against the mother country in order to protect themselves against unjustifiable and unbearable oppression. This is the position taken in the Declaration of Independence, and we have always looked upon the conflict through the eyes of the Declaration of Independence. The 13 colonies declared themselves free and independent on July 2, 1776, and then on July 4, 1776, adopted the Declaration of Independence, proclaiming to the world their reasons for declaring themselves free. Well, when they put that all men are created equal, or all what they supposed were men were equal, that was the end of that. They borrowed that crap from the French Revolution. Thus, the Declaration of Independence was not a Declaration of Independence, but a publication to the world of the causes which led the colonies to the point of such a declaration. It was an effort to put their side before the world and justify it. It was written by Thomas Jefferson in the heat of the great emotion. There's some argument about that. There's strong argument that Thomas Paine wrote the Declaration of Independence. 27 grievances were held against the Great Britain to justify the course taken by the colonies. We shall not attempt here to study the real nature of freedom, which is much more than a question of national boundaries and is even independent of national boundaries, but we shall accept the term in its usual narrow legal sense. The outstanding causes of the Revolutionary War were the following: the expulsion of the French from Canada in 1763, the attempt on the part of Britain to enforce the Navigation Acts, the British Western Land Policy, the British financial legislation regarding the colonies, the Stamp Act of 1776 or 1765, the Townshend Act of 1767, the Boston Tea Party of 1773, the five punitive acts of 1776, the general economic depression during the 70s, and religious conflicts. Let us examine briefly these 10 causes. 1. After the French were defeated by Great Britain in 1763 and lost Canada, the colonies did not feel the same need for protection by the mother country as formerly. Now remember here again that war with white people killing white people. And my interest is strictly racial, how bad these wars were for the white race. The French on the north were defeated. The Indians gave some trouble, but were not a great power to be dreaded. As a result, and of course those were the Mongols, don't like to call them Indians because they're not Indians, never were Indians. As a result, the colonies felt themselves to be self-supporting. Georgia was an exception because, as the youngest of the 13 colonies, it was dependent on England for subsidies and protection from the Indians or the Mongols. Thus, because the people recognized their dependence on Great Britain for protection, the movement for independence made slower headway in Georgia. I think a lot of things move slowly in Georgia. By far the most important cause of the American Revolution was the effort on the part of George III to enforce the navigation laws of Great Britain. It was customary then for every mother country to regard its colonies as trading posts. The colonies were considered necessary as the source of raw materials for the home manufacturers and also as a market for the surplus manufacturing goods of the home country. And, of course, that was all under the, what was the name of it? I'll think of it in a minute. The British mercantile system, but the name of it. This economic principle was a phase of mercantilism, which was the dominant economic doctrine at the time. In harmony with this theory, Great Britain, as early as 1651, began passing navigation acts requiring her colonies to trade only with British merchants. All the export trade of the colonies had to be sent to Great Britain, and all their imported goods had to come from Great Britain. In addition, the ships transporting these goods had to be owned by British subjects. This law, however, was openly violated by the colonial merchants. They traded with the Dutch or with any other foreigners they could. British officials in America were bribed and cooperated in this illegal trade. The leading people of New England at this time were merchants, and it has been estimated that 9/10 of these merchants were smugglers. Our great founding fathers were mostly smugglers, which is fine with me. John Hancock, who was to become president of the First Continental Congress in 1775, was a smuggler on a great scale, and at one time was sued for $500,000 as a penalty for smuggling. When did you read that in your school books, kiddies? John Adams was his counsel, his lawyer, his mouthpiece. If you want to read about it, see Simmons, a book with the title Social Forces in the United States History, unquote, pages 61 and 62. It was these merchants of the New England, and especially of Boston, who were among the leaders of the Revolution. After the close of the French and Indian War in 1763, England's merchants and English business in general had to be heavily taxed in order to pay the enormous national debt brought on by war. Accordingly, pressure was brought to bear on the British government to have the navigation laws enforced, which would give the English the colonial trade, thus enabling them to meet more easily the financial demands of taxation. Efforts were then made by Great Britain to enforce these navigation laws, which had been openly violated for more than a century. Their legality had never been questioned. It was the usual policy of all countries of that age in dealing with their colonies. These navigation laws were no doubt unwise interferences with trade, but their legality was not questioned, as all the modern tariffs are trade barriers, which does not make their violation legal. Besides, these laws did not entirely disregard the interests of the colonies. Great Britain gave them monopoly of tobacco raising, prohibiting Ireland from raising tobacco. Bounties or sums of money were often paid by the British government to the colonial producers to encourage industry. These bounties were paid on indigo, tar, pitch, hemp, and many other industries which Great Britain was attempting to establish in the colonies in order to keep the empire from finding it necessary to buy them from a foreign nation. These navigation laws aroused New England rather than the South, for it was the commercial section of the country. Another cause of friction between the colonies and the mother country was the British land policy proclaimed in 1763. This policy ordered the colonial governors to grant no more land to settlers beyond a certain western border extending south from New England states and along the western part of New York, Pennsylvania, Virginia, North Carolina, South Carolina, and Georgia. This line extended just east of the mountains and was to leave the Mongols the territory west of the mountains. This western land was then to be purchased from the Mongols for the king. After that, the Mongols would go further west, and their original territory was to be opened to settlers as soon as it was purchased. This arrangement was made by Great Britain to avoid conflict between the Indians and the frontier settlers. The frontier settlers, however, objected, preferring to drive the Mongols back by more ruthless methods, even if it caused trouble. The western land speculators also did not like it, because they could not sell their land until Great Britain had first pushed the Indian Mongols back. The royal government immediately began making treaties with the Mongols for the purchase of their territory. The policy was wise and humane, but the settlers were too impatient to abide by it. The Washington family was prominent in these western land speculations. That's George Washington. A land lobby was kept in London by these speculators in their efforts to get large grants of western land from the crown and then to sell it off as the country became more and more settled. Speculators. They never go away. The next principal cause of the trouble was the British financial legislation regarding the colonies. The colonies had issued a fiat money, or colonial bills of credit, which were a form of paper money. These could not be redeemed and immediately became depreciated in value. Yet they were made legal tender by the colonial legislature so that they had to accept in payment of debt. Often the colonies would buy goods from England and pay them with this colonial money. The southern planters were especially active in using it to pay their debts to British creditors. The merchants of London soon complained of this practice. Finally, in 1764, Great Britain prohibited all the colonies from issuing these bills of credit or fiat money, as such a procedure was considered unfair to their creditors. This, of course, aroused great opposition from those profiting by this currency when paying their debts. See, that's the plantation owners, the capitalists of their day. They liked that cheap money. Yet no one now would defend such a financial policy on the part of the colonies. The popular conception today is that the Stamp Act of 1765 was the principal, if not the sole cause of the American Revolution. This fact is greatly exaggerated, but it is the easiest to understand, and for that reason has been given the chief place among the many causes of the conflict. The Stamp Act was an act passed by Great Britain, requiring the placing of all legal documents of stamps to be sold to the colonies by Great Britain. The usual impression is that this revenue was to go to the mother country and was to be a continual tax upon the colonies for the sole benefit of the crown. This impression is entirely false, however. The revenue from these stamps was to be used to pay one-third of the expense of a colonial army of about 10,000 men to keep here for the defense of the colonies. Not one penny was to go to Great Britain. Examine any elementary text on United States history. They speak of taxing the colonies, but leaving the impression that the money was to go to Great Britain, whereas actually it was all to be spent for the protection of the colonies against the possible trouble with the Mongols and the French. This colonial army had been proposed before by the colonies. In 1739, colonial leaders under the leadership of the governor of Pennsylvania had themselves proposed such an army supported by such a tax. But at the time, they felt the danger of the French in Canada. After the defeat of the French in 1763, this danger was no longer so threatening. When the Stamp Act was passed in 1765, its operation was delayed for 1 year in order to give the colonies an opportunity to agree among themselves upon some other method of raising the money if they objected to the Stamp Act. The act was repealed in 1776 because of the bitter opposition of the colonies, who disliked a tax of any sort. Quote, "No taxation without representation," unquote, has been greatly overemphasized. It is only half true, for it implies that taxation with representation would have been accepted. When the colonies objected to the Stamp Act, calling it an internal tax, Great Britain repealed it, and in 1767 passed the Townshend Act, which provided for a tariff on imports to the colonies. The imported goods, however, were boycotted, and Great Britain was forced to repeal the tariffs on imports in 1770. The amount of the imported goods in New England colonies alone dropped from 1,363,000 pounds in 1768 to 504,000 pounds in 1769. After the repeal in 1770, the imports in 1771 were doubled. Thus, the boycott was a powerful weapon in the hand of the colonies. With it, the colonies were in a position to enforce almost any demand they liked upon Great Britain. When the Townshend duties were repealed in the 1770, a tax was still left on tea in order to assert the right to levy such a tax. In 1773, Great Britain allowed a tea company known as the East India Company to bring over a large quantity of tea. This company had been given a monopoly of the colonial tea market. When this tea arrived in Boston on December 16, 1773, a group of men entered the ship and threw overboard the cargo valued at about 15,000 pounds. But why was this tea destroyed? Simply because the leaders in this act were tea merchants in Boston, whose trade would have to compete with the newly arrived tea had it been permitted to enter the market. The act was the destruction of private property on the part of the participants. The more moderate element in Boston wanted the tea paid for and the action repudiated. As a punishment for this performance, Great Britain passed five punitive or coercive acts in 1774. These five acts were the following. Close the port of Boston until the tea should be paid for. Revise the charter of Massachusetts and sent to England for trial colonial agents accused of violence in the execution of their duties, stationed soldiers in Massachusetts to aid in the execution of the law, annexed to Quebec the land between the Ohio River and the Great Lakes. These acts were all legal. Great Britain had as much right to demand that the Boston pay for the tea destroyed as they would have to demand that a foreign power compensate our subjects for property lost there through the mob action of its subjects. Another cause of the revolution, often overlooked, was the general economic depression both in Great Britain and the colonies following the close of the French and Indian War, French and Mongol Wars of 1763. This was felt in all the industries. Depressions of this sort always create political unrest and a desire for a change in government, even though the authorities in power are in no way responsible for the condition. This is especially true in American political history. Presidential elections have been determined by economic conditions, having no direct bearing upon the issues involved. The tenth and the last cause we shall give of the American Revolution was the religious cause. There was a movement on foot to locate an Episcopal bishop in the colonies. At that time, all the clergy in the Episcopal Church were ordained in England, as were no bishop here. Consequently, all the Episcopal ministers came from abroad, and they were often mediocre, for the more efficient among them were kept in England. In 1770, there were about 250 Episcopal clergy in the colonies, most of whom in Virginia. The rumor of locating a bishop here aroused resentment in other denominations who unanimously opposed the plan. Now you see where Christ's insanity is part of the problem. But the most effective religious cause of the revolution came from still another source. When Great Britain extended Quebec down between the Ohio River and Great Lakes, the Catholic Church was made the established church in these regions, as it was in Quebec. This greatly incensed all the Protestants. Quote, "No Pope, no King," became one of the slogans of the Revolution. John Adams considered this religious animosity as much as any other cause of the War for Independence. Both these attitudes on the part of the colonies were unwise. An Episcopal bishop was badly needed here to elevate the Episcopal clergy and remove the unworthy ministers. The prejudice against the Catholics was simple folly. The Catholic priests in the colonies unanimously supported the revolution. If we examine the acts of the Great Britain which brought on the revolution, we find that they were all legal. They were all in harmony with the spirit of the age. There was simply a general breakdown of mercantilism. Patrick Henry especially talks about the rights of British subjects, but there were no such rights of which the colonies were being deprived. Had they remained in England, they would have enjoyed no privileges of which they were deprived by coming to America. Talk of this sort made effective oratory, but was false when examined, as usual pro-war is. No taxation without representation is not a legal matter, but a commonplace political philosophy. We have many other examples of taxation without representation. The great majority of people in England were then disenfranchised, yet they were taxed. Women were taxed before they were given the ballot. Many people are now taxed even in those states where they are deprived of the ballot. Phrases as this regarding taxation were merely effective generalities without any real meaning. The mistake of Great Britain was not in the passage of any illegal or unusual laws for governing the colonies, but it was in trying to rule a group of people against their will. Such a policy invariably invites trouble. Instead of the 13 units, as we usually regard the 13 colonies, there were three units differing in economic and political ideals. The coastal plains extended from New Hampshire to Pennsylvania, constituting one, which was dominated by commercial interests. The second was the Tidewater section from Maryland to Georgia, which was primarily agricultural and was dominated by the planters, plantation owners. The third unit or section was the frontier with extreme ideas about political democracy. The first unit was commercial and interested in trade and shipbuilding. Great mercantile families had grown up there, accumulating their wealth largely through the smuggling with the West Indies. What did your daddy do before the Revolution? To them, the navigation laws were especially offensive. Their chief desire was to restore the commercial conditions before 1763, yet they bitterly opposed the withdrawal from the British Empire, for they wanted its protection. They dominated Boston, Newport, New York, and Philadelphia. They were Whig in opposing trade restrictions, but Tory in opposing separation. They had no sympathy with the political radicalism of Jefferson, Henry, and such leaders. The second region was the Tidewater region of the South. It was dominated by the planters, plantation owners, many of whom were heavily in debt to British creditors. They secured the passage of lax bankruptcy laws detrimental to non-resident creditors. These laws, however, were vetoed by the king, as were the laws providing for colonial bills of credit. These planters felt themselves aristocrats, above the mob, among the lumpkin proletariat, above everybody. Although they opposed British financial policy, they likewise objected to the democracy of Jefferson. The third section was the frontier. This section had often been discriminated against by the older sections in matters of representation in colonial assemblies, administrations of justice, and taxation. Its inhabitants were zealous for their rights and had no economic interest to the contrary. In the domestic policies, they were out of harmony with the commercial and plantation owners. Their zeal for imagery, rights of man, gave great impetus to the movement for independence. Henry and Jefferson were the leaders of this section, and their point of view prevailed when the Declaration of Independence was written, the idea of which was shocking to the other sections. What the hell are these guys doing? These three sections reenacted differently to the various British acts. In Georgia, the frontier people were pro-British because they were dependent upon Britain for subsidies and protection from the Mongols. The frontier people of North Carolina were also Tory because they had a sharp difference with the eastern part of the state. Had the frontier of all the colonies had a similar sharp difference with the coastal plains, they would no doubt have been Tory and defeated the Revolution. The frontier of Virginia got possession of the state and furnished such leaders as Henry and Jefferson. The Revolution was an American phase of an English Civil War. It was not so much a conflict between England and the colonies as between different classes of the English people. It was a struggle between liberals and conservatives. The liberals were in control of the colonies while the conservatives were in control in England. In both countries, there was a large and influential minority group. The 13 colonies were a part of the British Empire and simply seceded, as the South did in 1860. The terms Whig and Tory are often misleading or vague when applied to this period. Many Whigs of Great Britain, such as Burke, Fox, and Pitt, were opposed to the British policy of regulating the colonies, but they were equally opposed to granting them independence. Many of the American moderates were Whig in opposing the British navigation policy, but wanted to pay for the tea destroyed in Boston. Many advocated an imperial union to handle such questions in the future. The radicals were for complete home rule and got control of the First Continental Congress of 1774. There was never a general uprising of the whole colonial population. John Adams estimated that about one-third of the population were opposed to separation. The greatest problem of the revolutionists was to keep the spirit of revolt alive. About 25,000 Americans enlisted in the British Army. When the radicals declared the colonies independent in 1776, many men of property were shocked. Henry Lorenz wept when he heard the Declaration of Independence read, but there was rejoicing among the radicals. A horse jockey neighbor said to John Adams, "Oh, Mr. Adams, what great things you and your colleagues have done for us. There are no courts of justice now in the province, and I hope there never will be any." There are many facts regarding our conduct during the Revolution which are not pleasant to relate. For example, on June 1, 1775, Congress passed a resolution disclaiming any intention of invading Canada. The report of this decision was widely circulated in Canada. About 4 weeks later, Congress secretly made plans for the invasion of Canada that fall. The invasion took place in September 1775, but Canada drove the invaders back. Is there any difference between our invasion of Canada and the German invasion of Belgium? Many people suspected of being Tories were terribly badly treated. The New York legislature passed a resolution that Tories should be deemed guilty of treason and should suffer death, unquote. They were often hunted by mobs, tarred and feathered, and killed. American troops set fire to the houses of people who to plunder and rob. In fact, in some sections, the colonists looked upon the British army with as much favor as the American army. New York alone confiscated $3.6 million worth of property belonging to the Tories, and all the other states did likewise. See here? Fratricide again. Fratricide. During the entire period, the Tories were the great sufferers. It is obvious that a person had as much legal moral right to be a Tory as to be a Whig, provided that he committed no act of violence against society. And the great majority of Tories had committed none. It was simply a question of difference of opinion. To punish a person for a difference of opinion cannot, of course, be harmonized with democracy. Majority rule does not mean coercion of minorities. Dictatorship of the majority can be the worst kind of despotism. When Great Britain recognized the independence of the colonies in 1783, one provision of the treaty agreed to by both parties was that the Tories should be compensated by the states for the property confiscated during the conflict. The states, however, did nothing about it, but treated that provision as a scrap of paper. Compare that to what they demanded of the Germans, the Jews did after World War II. Was our separation from Great Britain a wise or an unwise step? It is impossible to answer a question of this sort with certainty. We assume that it was wise and beneficial, but to determine that, it would be necessary to roll history back, to let us remain a part of Great Britain, and then compare the two conditions. It has been argued that if we had remained a part of British Empire, the democratic spirit of the colonies would have been a great help in the democratic element in Great Britain, that these elements cooperating would have democratized and federated all the English-speaking peoples, basically, you know, white people, which in turn would have democratized the world. Such an idea almost be upheld with assurance. But neither can one say dogmatically that the American Revolution resulted in our separation was for the best. We use the term freedom and independence in too loose a sense when we say that we gained our freedom or independence. Would the South have been free and independent if it had been the winning faction in the Civil War? Secession or the changing of national boundaries does not give freedom. Canada is free, although a part of the British Commonwealth. Texas is free, although a part of the United States. And that's the end of the argument against the separation from England using the American Revolution. Now, when reading this, I hope you understand, and I'm wanting you to see it from a position of race, where we... Did the white race do right by separating from England? I think racially, no. I think that, and then, of course, the ideas of the Mongols making deals with the Mongols when it was, I don't know. I think that with Might is Right, the Mongols had to be moved out. Because there again, if you look at it from a racial view, if you mixed all those Mongols with the white settlers, you know what would probably happen, and in some cases it did happen. So always look at it on the about race. How does it affect the race? Most of these arguments are about economics. And economics can be very bad for the race. And fratricide of all the men, British men and colonial men that died in the Revolution, plus all the imported Germans, Hessians, that died in the war, and the Canadians that died. And, you know, was it worth it? I begin to think not. Well, that's it for today, boys and girls, on Moon's Day. I hope I didn't bore you to death, but I want to get through this little thin book because too many of our people, they're in the right wing. They may be racial. They say they're racial, but the racial logic doesn't really go to what it needs to be, because we keep saying, well, like World War One, World War Two, kill those bastard Germans, you know. The Germans say, kill all those bastard French. World War Two, after World War Two, kill all those Russians, and Russians kill all those Americans. See, that's totally bad for the white race. And that's what I want you to get on any decision or idea. Think race. Is it good for the race or bad for the race? 14.5.